Nifty Podcast, presented by Partyfish Media, a showcase of the best emerging filmmakers under the age of 25 from all around the world. Film starts here at Nifty 2022 in Seattle, Washington, our 15th edition. My name is Dan Hudson. I'm the executive director of Nifty and one of the programmers here. And it is my pleasure to be speaking with the filmmaker of Malihini today. Please introduce yourself.
Hello, my name is Ha'aheo Awai Decker. I, at the time of recording this, am a senior at Seattle University. And yeah, I'm just a young Hawaiian filmmaker who loves to create.
And you're in attendance at Seattle University, but you're also from Seattle here. So I'm curious to hear what it's been like attending Nifty kind of as a hometown festival, local filmmaker.
It's been really interesting. I moved up here to Seattle when I was 13 years old. I came from Southern California, so I was living in Orange County, and before that I was living in Pasadena. So I was very like kicking and screaming when I first came up here. I was like, I'm a California kid through and through. I will never be a Seattle kid. But lo and behold, I've lived here for 10 years, and it's really nice to be able to like show people around and be like, I know how to take the five. I know where to show those things. Oh, do you need non-touristy things to do? I can tell you those things. Yeah, it's been so funny and so interesting, like coming to Nifty for the first time. I used to, the high school I went to was the Center School. And I had a lot of friends of mine who had gone through Nifty, had done the like 48-hour film challenge for the Center School. And you know, in high school, I never did any of the film classes. I watched all my friends do film, and I watched all the people at Center do film, and I was like, you look stupid and pretentious. I will never be one of you, and I will never do film. And then I did it. And it's been so fun and exhilarating being here for the first time. I've been coming to the SIFF Uptown for years, but to be here as a filmmaker and to have the anticipation of watching my film on the big screen has been nerve-wracking.
So you got into Seattle University. Did you go straight to the film program if you weren't doing it in high school, or how did that end up?
No, funnily enough, because I'm sure a lot of locals will know about this, I was adamant about not doing film, and then when I was 17 years old, I did the apprenticeship program through Real Girls, which is now defunct. But it was this wonderful organization dedicated to getting young women and young non-binary filmmakers into the industry, preciously run by Laura Jean Cronin. Now under the stewardship of Northwest Film Forum as RG Pro. But doing that apprenticeship program really made me understand just like how much I love being on set and how much I love creating things. And just being able to do the tech aspect of film, like from camera to audio to editing, and being able to say things to my family members of like, I can do this thing. And they're like, what are you talking about? It was so much fun. And so going into college from doing that apprenticeship program, I didn't go straight away into the film program. I, for a long time, thought that I should go into a more realistic field and should study with something that is like a good backup plan. So I had originally started as a pre-major, and then I was going to register my major as a social work major, and then a sociology major, and then a psychology major. But I just kept coming back to film, and I just kept coming back to film classes, and I couldn't deny how much I loved doing film. So I finally declared my major when I, at the end of my sophomore year, and literally like 2 weeks after I declared, the pandemic hit.
Nice, good timing.
Yeah.
Well, with this particular film that you're at Nifty with this year, I know it's had a chance to screen at a few festivals, both locally, and I don't know if you've had a chance to tour with the film to other festivals, or if the pandemic changed that at all. But yeah, what's it been like sharing this film with audiences?
Oh my God, it's been quite something. I've been going to film festivals for Malihini for the past year now. A lot of them are virtual due to the pandemic and the nature of the pandemic. And so Nifty is actually the first festival I've been to with like such a large audience. The last screening that Malahini had was at the Seattle Asian American Film Festival, and it was for a drive-in screening. And so, obviously, it was beautiful and amazing to see all the cars pulled up into the little driveway parking lot and watching people absolutely enamored with the projector. But it was downpour, raining that day, and so all the cars got fogged up, so I couldn't see anybody's reactions. And it was like we were tuning in to the radio, so I couldn't hear everybody else's experiences because they had their windows up. So all I really knew from that experience was seeing the whole line of cars, but not necessarily the like person experience. So Nifty is my first experience of meeting a bunch of filmmakers and them having like either seen the film through me sending it to them or a bunch of filmmakers being very excited to see it. I did not realize how big of a deal closing night was when I first came to Nifty. I just thought, oh, you know, I programmed in closing night. And so the amount of like veteran alums who are here this weekend would come up and they're like, oh, when's your film showing? And I'd say closing night. And they're like, what? That's crazy. And I'm like, yeah. It's crazy, yeah.
Well, kind of touching on that, you know, we're recording this before closing night, this film kind of touched on the one of the big themes that we saw in the three lines of the festival this year, which is home, and like how we feel about that, especially like the kind of myriad of meetings that it's had for a bunch of different people, in the past couple years. So, I mean, was that kind of a launching point for you and like exploring this film, or was it like you were having conversations with your mom and like that was kind of what was coming up and resonating? What was the jumping off point for this project?
It's so funny. Jumping off point for this film originally started as just like a small college assignment for a social justice cinema class I was taking with the secretary of the board of directors on Nifty. Shout out to Alex Johnston.
Nice.
he was my professor at the time, and he gave us this assignment called Where Do You Stand? And so we had to make a short film based off of where we stand as social activists, what kind of social movements we align ourselves with. And I really wanted to do like a documentary on the different social movements I had been involved with. You know, this was coming like right after the George Floyd protests that were happening in Seattle, and you know, Seattle Pride being canceled once again, and so many things were going on, and I really wanted to, but I just kept coming back to the fact that first and foremost, like where I stand is being Hawaiian, and I had been wrestling a lot with my identity for a long time. You know, one of the things that was a part of the film was, as someone who's Hawaiian and my father is white, for a long time I had convinced myself that I was a child of like white supremacy, that if it wasn't for colonial systems, I would not exist, because if colonial systems didn't exist, then Hawaii would be a free, thriving nation. You know, white people wouldn't have come to Hawaii and claimed it as their own, and my father would not have shown up with along with those you know, migrations of people. And so from that, it was that feeling of, if I feel this way, of feeling not Hawaiian enough, and this feeling of struggling with this idea of home, of like feeling a loss of a home that I never knew in the first place, then I'm sure my mother feels a myriad of ways about that. Because I think so often when we have these conversations of identity, of not feeling like enough, especially for those of multicultural identities, we so often sort of center ourselves and center our individual experience when it's like, my mother made me who I am today. My father's experiences made me who I am today. So many people made me the way that I am. And if I'm going to be having these kinds of conversations and telling this kind of story, then it's very important to center not just mine, but my mother's experience as well.
And I'm super curious, like as a Howley, as a white guy, I had to look up Malahini, and I could see that it kind of had a few different definitions, one of which that I presume might be like foreigner or something. I was super curious, like, what does it mean for you in the context of this film and why you titled it that?
It's so funny because Malhini had remained nameless and untouched for a very long time. I made this project and then I wasn't going to submit it. I was just gonna keep it there, remain nameless somewhere on some shelf in my computer or something. And then Alex Johnston was like, you have to submit, and I'm going to make you submit to things, and I'm going to make you submit to Nifty. But we had to name it before I could submit it. And so for a very long time, I just kept sitting with what to name it. I could never come up with a name. And then Malhini came to my mind. And Malhini means foreigner. Hali used to be the word for a foreigner. It used to be the word for foreigner, somebody who's on the outside. And since the influx of tourism, plantation work, Hali has since been transformed into a word that just means white people. And so Malhini sort of came out of that from a new word. Most people today use Malhini as a word for tourists, people who come to Hawaii as a visitor, as a foreigner, an outsider. And so I wanted to play with that word as a way to showcase my mother's experience of being a foreigner here in this country. At one point in the film, she says, I feel like I'm a foreigner in a foreign country in a foreign continent. And by being a foreigner, it doesn't mean that I don't respect the land. It doesn't mean that I don't respect the people. It just means that being a foreigner means that I'll never truly belong here. And so, yeah, Malhini sort of came from that, like, line that she says in the film of, you know, if she feels like a foreigner here, and I feel like a foreigner from the place that I come from, like, what does it mean to belong somewhere, and what does it mean to be a foreigner foreigner to somewhere?
Yeah, that's really interesting, really powerful. I'm curious because you mentioned that that you were, like, originally from, like, Pasadena area. Yeah. And I know there's a Pacific Islander community down there. There's a bit of a Pacific Islander community here in Seattle. Mm-hmm. So, like, do you feel like that you're able to have, like, a community, or do you, like, really feel like you're always the only, like, Native Hawaiian in, like, whatever circles you're in? Or
yeah, it's I lived in Hawaii until I was 3 years old. I'm from the Big Island, and so coming up here from California was a huge culture shock for me. I had a lot of, like, aunties and uncles and family friends in California that were Pacific Islander, and just a whole range of Pacific Islanders. Like a family friend of ours who I consider my auntie, and her kids, my, like, cousins, I call them my cousins. They're Tongan, Samoan, and Hawaiian. There's, like, so many Pacific Islanders in Hawaii, in California. And when I was living in California, I would dance hula with my mom. We would have, like, every Saturday with family, we'd make poke from fresh fish from the markets in Huntington Beach and all that. And then I moved up here, and there was no Pacific Islanders in Seattle, like, as a city that is overwhelmingly white. It was very hard for me. It was, like, a huge culture shock. And the only places that you could find Pacific Islanders, when I was growing up here, at least, like, from middle school to high school, it was in Tacoma or in Renton or in Burien, like, little pockets here and there. But in places that are not accessible for a kid who can't drive, and parents who are working full-time who also don't have the time. I mean, like, even just the fact that, like, the Pacific Islander Alliance for Washington is in federal way, which I would love to go to someday. I just got my license in November, so maybe I will once I get more comfortable with driving on highways. But yeah, it's just, like, stuff like that, of just feeling for a very long time in the city a sense of not belonging, and finding places where I could belong, like feeling a sense of multicultural identity from people that I could be in community with, right? Like, there's an amazing and beautiful East African community in Seattle, and there's a thriving Vietnamese community, and just, like, an absolutely abundant community of Filipinos here. And so just, like, the little pockets. You take joy in the little things.
Yeah. I mean, there at least it seems like in Seattle, at least there's, like, a little bit of more of, like, at least recent years, like, mainstreaming a bit of, like, you were mentioning poke and stuff, like, there's poke shops all over Seattle now and stuff. I personally, one of my favorite restaurants in Seattle is Mono, but I don't know if you ever eat there, if that's, like, gentrified Hawaiian food or something, but, like, I'm wondering, like, do you feel like that's, like, a positive thing, or do you, like, it's like, this is just, like, more colonialism, like, you know?
I feel like it's not a great thing. It's very funny. Coming out of Seattle Asian American Film Festival, I was telling this to the programmers there and in a few articles I did for Molahiti in its Seattle Asian American Film Festival release. I have submitted to SAF as a joke, and I didn't think I'd get it, and then I got it because I had submitted to a whole slew of Asian Pacific Islander film festivals, given the fact that I am Pacific Islander, and I had been resoundingly rejected by all of them. And when I checked all of their scheduling and what they had programmed, overwhelmingly it was all East Asian. There was not Southeast Asian representation, there was not South Asian representation, and even more so, there was no Pacific Islander representation. And so for me, it's really difficult, like, seeing poke restaurants come up, or seeing Japanese restaurants sell poke, and seeing these little pop-ups of the way that the greater society and people come to think Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders are one big thing, when we're not. We're very different, we have very different cultures, we have very different experiences, and that does not deny the very entwined history of Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, right? Like, for me, my great-grandfather had immigrated from the Philippines to Hawaii as a sugar plantation worker, and that's a very important part of my family history. But that does not mean that me being Hawaiian makes me Asian American. I do not know the experiences of Asian Americans. I did not face the onslaught of violence that Asian Americans had to go through during the pandemic, just as Asian Americans did not have to go through the onslaught of colonial violence for Hawaii.
Yeah, well, you know, kind of disambiguating this sort of, like, I guess, lumping in to Pacific Islanders and Native Hawaiians into, like, the kind of greater, like, Asian American diaspora, or, you know, what have you. You know, in film and media, at least in recent years, like, some very high profile, like, Pacific Islanders, like Taika Waititi and, like, The Rock and stuff. So, like, but at the same time, it's also kind of paralleling just in general. A real desire, and on behalf of, I think, a lot of institutions trying to actually be really genuine about this, you know, uplifting Indigenous voices as well.
Absolutely.
And so I'm curious, like, what trends are you seeing that, like, are resonating for you? Because I also know that sometimes it can get a bit sticky. Like, there was a bunch of pushback around, like, Moana, when people were like, you're, like, mashing too much, like, Polynesian cultures together and stuff. But, like, so, yeah, I'm curious, like, do you feel like this is a great time for representation
absolutely.
And everything?
I think so. I'm very hopeful for Malahini, and very hopeful for my career and my success. Something that I've seen in recent years that I'm extremely excited about is there's been a, like, renaissance of Hawaiian filmmaking. In the last, like, 5 years, we've seen just numerous Hawaiian filmmakers from Hawaii and from the mainland who are Hawaiian, like, making Hawaiian stories that aren't just about tourism and not just about, like, having to struggle.
It's not just, like, all, like, the White Lotus or
whatever. It's not just, like, the White Lotus or, like, you know, it's been so refreshing to see representations of Native Hawaiian people that aren't just, like, you know, Lilo and Stitch, like, stuff like that. Yeah, like there's been some beautiful short films that have come out this past year from filmmakers like Aina Paikai. At Sundance this year, there was a Native Hawaiian filmmaker by the name of Alika Tangan who came out with a feature film called Every Day in Kaimuki about a Hawaiian man who moves away from home and that experience of wanting to leave so badly, but also not wanting to leave. And that's a very like particular experience for Hawaiians. Like being from Hawaii is such a special thing, and being connected to home and being connected to all the people and all the places, but also knowing that if you live in those islands for so long, you're gonna be stuck and you don't wanna be stuck. And also just like the fact that, you know, recently there was an article that came out that about the most expensive places to live. And number one was Hawaii, and how Hawaii is becoming increasingly too expensive for Hawaiians to live. And so to what point is Hawaii without Hawaiians?
Mm-hmm. I had a couple questions for you about the like the techniques and the aesthetics of the film itself before we run out of time here. When I was watching it, it kind of felt like there was this like double vision to it. Like it kind of had like a red blue shift to almost kind of like watching like Anaglyph 3D without the glasses. And I was curious like why you chose that effect or like how you came to it. Because to me, it kind of had like a tie-in thematically to the film. Like there's kind of like some dueling identities. You know, I don't know. Like, sorry, maybe I'm projecting
no,
it too
good,
much.
You're but... good. I love that. No, it's so funny. Mauhini came with a lot of happy accidents. I filmed this at the height of the pandemic, and so, you know, I didn't own any equipment at the time, and I had no means of borrowing from friends because we were like, we don't want to break the bubbles that we have to keep each other safe. And a lot of rental places in the city at the time were also closed. And so I filmed this with my phone and I recorded it with my phone, which was such a funny experience. So I did the interview with my mom first. It was about an hour and a half of me pulling up FaceTime on my computer and then getting my phone out and recording on voice memos. And then the next week afterwards, after we had like, you know, made sure that we were social distancing and quarantining for that time, we met up and it was just a day of recording, spending a day with her. And for me, I wanted it to like the aesthetics of the film, the product that came out from my phone. I wanted it to feel like watching a home video almost. Very much like inspired by like I was going through my family's garage one day and I found just an onslaught of like video tapes that were in an old like Sony camcorder and watching them and just seeing the way that the like tapes would either break a little bit and there'd be a little scratchiness to it or just seeing the way that like I think the most visceral experience was I found a tape, and when I pulled it and I put it in, it was the first tape I had seen of me being a little kid in Hawaii. I had never seen that. I don't really remember much from it. I would, like, remember bits and pieces of growing up in Hawaii. But that was the first time that I had like, seen little chunks of my life that I had lived of being in Hawaii, and I don't remember it, but I had lived it. And there was just like little like bits and pieces here that were a little scratchy. And yeah, so when I started editing it, I would say that I was sufficient in Premiere Pro, but not amazing at it. You know, enough to do freelance work to make ends meet. So I just started messing around. Like, a lot of happy accidents came out of just messing around with Premiere Pro. I did not know how to fix the sequence settings, so the aspect ratio of Mauhini was a total accident. It was, like, I did not know how to change it to the original aspect ratio that I had filmed it in, and so I was like, why is it a square? How do I fix this? And then I fixed it, and I was like, I miss the square. I like it better as a square. This feels so much like more intimate with the aspect ratio that I had messed up in, quote unquote. And so stuff like that, or like the red, I was just like messing around in the colors. That's like one piece of advice I'd like to tell like younger students of at SU, like, don't be afraid to mess around. Don't be afraid to like do things outside of the box. And even if we're taught a certain way of how to deal with the technology that we've been given, feel free to like do whatever you want. So I was just messing around and I had accidentally turned one of the shots completely red. And I was like, I hate the way this looks, but maybe if I just shifted it over just a little bit to the left and I put the original footage over it, I wonder how it would look. And then I really liked it, and the way that it like played off of, especially my mother's red hula skirt, mm-hmm. or the way that the cars would pass by when we drove. So I was like, okay, it needs a companion. So that's when I included the blue and just moved it like 5 degrees to the left.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right, so I nailed it. there was intentional layering, and it was doubled up. Okay. So it, when you're talking about producing this, you were also mentioning that like you're doing it over FaceTime and using voice memos and stuff. So what was the decision to like have the audio like completely disjointed from the video? Because that also felt like it was adding kind of to the theme of like feeling like distanced and like
it was definitely like, I mean, part of it when I had started recording it, you know, my mom was like, I told my mom when we had started recording the interview, I said, look, I want you to speak however you like. I need you to know that I'm going to honor your story and what you say. Because, a little tangential, one of my biggest pet peeves about documentary, especially today, is that I feel like a lot of documentaries fall into the trap of trying to achieve a call to action or trying to achieve an overall theme. And it completely just like takes away from the story of their protagonists, and it feels really disingenuous as like a viewer to see 4 or 5 years or even just like a year of being with these people and taking a piece of these people and immortalizing it, and it's not them. Mm-hmm. It's not real, almost. And so for me, my mom's story is so rock solid and such a foundation. I was like, I need you to know that I'm gonna take what you say, not just as your daughter, but as a filmmaker, and honor it. Mm-hmm. And so my mom was like, okay, I'm not wearing makeup, is that okay? And I was like, it's okay, we're not gonna record this. I don't really want to record through the computer screen, because for me, like, us both being in our bed, like being in our separate beds, talking to each other through a computer screen, recording through a phone, that was like our moment. And I didn't want to share that with other people. I didn't want to share with people the like vulnerability of having to talk to your mother about these really hard subjects and not be face to face with it. Like, we were not next to each other, but we had shared this moment in our separate vulnerable spaces. And I was like, yeah, I'm not gonna let the viewers have the pleasure of seeing the inside of your space or seeing the pleasure of my space, and the collective creation of our space. They'll simply just get a little peek into it through our voices.
That was beautiful, and it obviously landed. It obviously came through, because as we've kind of talked about, it's in closing night, so bravo. Yeah, I think we're starting to run out of time here. So just kind of as like sort of winding down and kind of like talking about you as a filmmaker and kind of what's next for you. You know, I'm curious, because obviously you can consider this a documentary piece. Some might also say this is experimental or like some sort of like hybrid of the two. So like as you're like developing your voice and like, you know, the kind of projects that you want to keep working on, like, Is it sort of like, do you want to continue in this vein, or like, is this kind of like, this is just like, this isn't me, this is like, I did it for this style, for this like particular project, because that's what this project needed? Or yeah, kind of curious, like, what's next for you?
I think what's next for me is just making whatever I feel like. I never want to be pigeonholed into a genre, and I think especially for Indigenous people and people of color, when it comes to this film industry, oftentimes, like, filmmakers of color are pigeonholed into telling stories of representation or into a particular genre. And to that, I say, no, thank you. I will just make whatever I want, and I will make whatever I feel called to. And know that it's like, it's mine. It's deeply mine, and it's a part of myself that I'm sharing with people. And through that, it's sort of this symbiotic conversation that I'm having with audience members, even if it's not like a talking conversation. People are interacting with what I make. People are digesting what I make. And even if maybe they won't remember it 5-10 years down the line, they witnessed it. And, you know, I think it's so funny. I had recently had a conversation with another filmmaker here, Peter Zeist, because we had done it for the Nifty Connect video series.
Oh, hell yeah.
And so we were talking, and he had watched the film, and he said, what was great about watching your film is that I can't even think of a way to put it into a genre. It's, like, so much more than any genre that I can think of. Like, first I want to think of documentary, then it's experimental, and then it's slice of life, and then it's so many things, and I don't know where to put it. And that's what I seek out to be as a filmmaker, is making things that are surprising and unexpected, and first and foremost, transformative.
Beautiful. Oh my God. That's it. That's the soundbite. We got to leave it there. We got nothing else to say. That's the mic drop without actually dropping the mic. Well, thank you so much for being here today. Where can people follow you? Do you have a Instagram handle, Vimeo, whatever, like whatever you want to share?
I have a Vimeo, which is in the works. It is my first and last name, Ha'aheo Owai Decker. I have an Instagram. It is at young.kanaka. And yeah, come join me, see all the journeys and amazing things I can or will be up to.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for joining here, and I'm looking forward to the closing night screening.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. For more information on Nifty 2022 or upcoming events, the talented youth, or more emerging filmmakers, check out nifty.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter at NFFTY or Instagram and TikTok at Nifty Film. For more podcasts from Party Fish Media, search Party Fish Media wherever you listen, or check out our website at partyfish.media. Party Fish Media acknowledges that it operates and records on Indigenous Duwamish and Puget Sound Coast Salish land that is still home to the Duwamish tribe. This land is stolen in violation of the Point Elliott Treaty of 1855. We are committed to uplifting the name of these lands and community members from these nations who reside alongside us. For more information on this land, its people, or ways you can help, visit duwamishtribe.org or realrentduwamish.org.